देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्त वृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्णा। So having discussed the Supreme Absolute Truth, Krishna, and also having talked about His being a person ultimately, and also that the form is superior to the formless aspect of anything, and in particular of the Lord, and having described how the Supreme Absolute Truth is the complete whole, who is the source of other complete wholes, and yet that complete whole remains complete at all times, and the perceived incompleteness in these smaller complete wholes is that they do not remember their relationship with the larger complete whole, that is Krishna. The moment the relationship with Krishna is realized, once again the apparent lack of completeness disappears. Completeness appears in proportion to how much we have re-established our connection with the complete whole. And having described this, Srila Prabhupada then begins talking about the Vedic wisdom, but how Vedic wisdom is infallible, it is also complete, and he gives an example of how cow dung is pure even though it is the dung of an animal. So therefore we have to accept whatever is stated in the Vedic scriptures as true, even if it seems to differ with the information that is provided by sense perception. So Srila Prabhupada in the next paragraph, that is the last paragraph on page 15, continues to deal with the topic of Vedic knowledge and the process of acquiring knowledge, epistemology. It is a very important field, important for us to know also. So we'll read, quote, Vedic knowledge is not a question of research, unquote. That itself is a topic for a thesis. What is research? We go through so many investigations and we try to come up with something that was not known before. That is the purpose of research. All the research going on is done with the idea of coming up with some knowledge that was not known to others and that was not known before. Whether it's scientific research or this research or that research. But Vedic knowledge is not a question of research. Why? Because it's already known. It's known to whom? It's known to the self-realized. And Prabhupada is going to talk about that. From where do we understand? We understand it from the place where it is already known. It is not a question of speculating, doing so-called research to try to understand what the truth is. It is already known. It's only a question of learning what is already existing, what is already known, and realizing that knowledge. Vedic knowledge is revealed. This is the important point. It is not simply to be understood by research, either by empirical research or by book knowledge, by book research. It is something that is revealed when the Lord is pleased with the transcendentalist, with the candidate. And there is a process. But that process is not a question of modern day research. Trying to find out, sitting with 15 editions of the Bhagavad Gita and finding out which one of them is more accurate. There's one newspaper commentator who, in one particular article, normally he doesn't write about spiritual subjects, but on one train journey I happened to see a newspaper. And I was going through and I saw this column written by a famous commentator, and this particular article was devoted to his study of the Bhagavad Gita. Naturally, it was all nonsense. That is to be expected. But he had tried to analyze all the different editions of Bhagavad Gita. This one, that one. He named all the ones. And then he also, in the passing, mentioned, I also read Bhaktivedanta's Bhagavad Gita. But it was too much in the Chaitanya tradition of Bengal, so I didn't like it. So his reason for choosing some particular edition as being bona fide, according to him, was that it should have appealed to his intellectual mind. He said there was something original in such and such person. He said something which the others have not said, very original. What is more original than Krishna's word? There's no question of us trying to produce anything more original than that. And what is the value, even if we do produce something original, what is the value of that? Even in the Chatushloki Bhagavatam, the Lord tells Brahma, if there's something that is seen as separate from me, what is the value of it? Because it's illusion. So however intellectual and scholarly it may sound, if it does not have relationship with Krishna and Krishna's message, it is simply valueless. So people try to come up with their own concocted ideas of the Gita. And they do their speculation and research. But Prabhupada, in the very first line, he says, Vedic knowledge is not a question of research. Then he's going to talk a little bit about why it is so. What is wrong with our research? Quote, Vedic knowledge, or rather, I beg your pardon, our research work is imperfect because we are researching things with imperfect senses. Unquote. So this is another reason why there is no question of research for Vedic knowledge. One is because we research something which is already, we are trying to research something which is already known. Vedic knowledge is already known. And the second reason is that we are trying to research with certain instruments which are defective. Even if our technology is superb, very nice microscopes and telescopes and everything, but ultimately it is our senses that have to perceive through these instruments. So ultimately it is our senses that are the instruments. The senses are defective. So with defective instruments, how can we get perfect knowledge? Let's go further. We have to accept perfect knowledge which comes down, as it is stated in Bhagavad Gita, by the parampara, disciplic succession. Unquote. In other words, Prabhupada is talking about two processes of acquiring knowledge. One is through our own research efforts, our own abilities, our own intelligence, and so on. And the other is accepting from the parampara, the disciplic succession that comes down from Krishna. One process is called the ascending process, and the other process is called the descending process. The ascending process is which one? Research or receiving in parampara? Research. What is the Sanskrit word for it? Aroha pantha. It is called Aroha Pantha. Aroha means to climb, to ascend. Why is it called the ascending process, the climbing process? Who would like to explain? Yes.
Because it is own endeavor.
It is one's own endeavor, yes. So still, why ascending? Why do you say it is ascending, climbing? You go towards
perfection or
truth? Go towards perfection or the truth, yes, somewhat.
We are nearing the truth.
You are nearing the truth, alright.
Which God thinks, obviously, you are trying to find out the source, and finally, you will try to find the ultimate.
Yes, that is correct. We start with what we see, and then we try to produce, go upwards, higher and higher, to higher truths. You see some particular episodes. You see things happening here, here, here. And then you try to generalize it and make higher truths, more generalizations. You see an apple falling here. You see an apple falling there. You see apple falling here, apple falling there. Apple falling everywhere in many places. And you say, yes, that means there is gravity and everywhere this must apply. So even on some other planet, apple will fall. You are ascending to higher, higher, higher knowledge. From what you see, you start off with particular things, observations. And from the particular, you move to the general. You try to come to general conclusions, bigger laws, bigger theories, based upon individual observations. And then you try to conclude, based on your observations, some truth which becomes your theory or your law. That is the ascending process. Aroha pantha. So what is the problem with this process? What's wrong with it? Yes? Very correct. First and foremost, our senses are imperfect. So whatever knowledge or observations themselves which we have gained through our senses are defective. And our whole body of knowledge is based on this defective foundation of information we have gained from our senses. Secondly, I'll add another point to that. That there is also a lot of information that is not available to our senses, that is not within the range of the senses. What about that? So we are not able to include that information to build up our theory. So we are taking only a small portion of the knowable universe and trying to make some general law out of it. So whereas what is knowable to our senses is a very small portion of what is actually available in the universe, what is existing. And secondly, even of what we can see and hear and perceive, there are defects because our senses are imperfect. And on top of that, because once you have all the observations that you have made, you have to draw some conclusion, some inference, anuman, pramana. Just as pratyaksha pramana, direct observation, is not complete, it is not the best form of evidence. Even the form of inference by which you draw conclusions, that is also defective, that is called anuman, pramana. That is also problematic. Let's take an example. Now, how many of us believe that man is mortal? Man is mortal means that every man dies. Do we believe this?
Yes.
How many of us believe that every man will die? Any doubt? How many of us have actually tried to experiment and do research? How would you do research? Suppose somebody wanted to do research. Let us see if man is mortal. He goes and checks one person, two persons. He finds everyone dying, dying. He says millions of people he sees dying. He goes to a war battlefield. He goes to an aeroplane crash site. He goes to a hospital. He goes here and there. He has died, he has died, he has died, he has died. But can he still conclude that man is mortal? Why not? Yes? Because he has not seen every man die. Suppose there are 10 million people. And of the 10 million, he has researched everyone except one person. And the one person could be immortal. Who knows? How would you know unless he dies? How would you know? There is no way of knowing. So this is called the ascending process. You try to research and come to a conclusion. But by the descending process, we take that for granted. You start with a general point. You don't start with particular observations and go towards a general conclusion. You start with a conclusion. The conclusion is that man is mortal, that every man will die. And then you bring it down to specific examples and say, yes, he will also die, he will die, he will die, everyone will die. So it is much easier to follow the descending process, which is called the Avaroha Pantha. Another example. Does God exist? It's a question. Suppose you want to do research. Somebody is finding out, is this God, is that God, is this God, is that God? No, 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 no. And he comes to the conclusion, God does not exist. Then we ask him the question, do you know everything? Who can answer yes, except Krishna? So naturally he will say no. So our response would be, well, maybe the one thing that you don't know is Krishna, is God. So how can you say there is no God? You can only say there is no God if you know everything and then you have concluded that there is no God. But you don't know everything. So one thing you don't know may be God. So your process of trying to establish whether God exists or not through the ascending process is defective because your senses are limited. You can't possibly know everything in the first place. So how can you establish any firm conclusion? Rather, we accept from a higher source, yes, there is God. God exists. It's so much easier. It is so much better just to accept on faith from the right source. Actually, it's not such a surprising thing. We are doing it all the time. Every school student is studying, for example, geography. In geography, maybe in the 5th standard or 4th standard, he may hear that there is a country called Japan, there is a country called China, there is a country called, let's say, South Africa. Now, is the student going to, how will you check? If the student is going to doubt his geography book, well, actually, I don't know, let me do research to see if Japan exists. Then he will try to find out, he will go here and there, ultimately he will have to go to Japan. And even when he goes to Japan, he is not sure whether this is really Japan or some other country. It's impossible. Imagine, this is just for one country, Japan. And if he wants to do research for all the countries, how will he be able to do? Even in order to establish whether one country is Japan, it will take him his whole life. And how does he know that this particular country is Japan? What if others are fooling him? So there is no end to this kind of logic. Man claims that astronauts have gone to the moon. Prabhupada says, who knows whether they went to the moon or they went somewhere else? Maybe they went somewhere else, but they think that that is the moon. Because there is no way to conclude, no way to establish. So even the school students, even the normal process of acquiring material knowledge is based upon, largely upon the descending process. In school, we have learnt everything by the descending process. The foundation of our knowledge, of which we are so proud, is all by the descending process. And then when we are sufficiently fed with all this information, then we say, now we will do research and we will go by the ascending process. But fundamentally, it's all the descending process. The alphabets we have learnt, the mathematics we have learnt, the world around us, geography, history, everything we have learnt by the descending process. So why should we have a different criterion when it comes to spiritual knowledge? Why should we think that for spiritual knowledge alone we should have only the ascending process? It makes sense that we should also receive knowledge from a higher source, just as we are doing in our school books, in our college books. So what is that source of knowledge? That source of knowledge, Prabhupada explains, is the disciplic succession, the parampara that comes from Krishna directly. That is the source of the most perfect knowledge. We receive it in parampara. So more about this, as Prabhupada speaks. Let us go ahead. Quote, we have to receive knowledge from the proper source in the cyclic succession, beginning with the Supreme Spiritual Master, the Lord Himself, and hand it down to a succession of spiritual masters. Arjuna, the student who took lessons from Lord Sri Krishna, accepts everything that he says without contradicting him. One is not allowed to accept one portion of Bhagavad Gita and not another. No, we must accept Bhagavad Gita without interpretation, without deletion, and without our own whimsical participation in the matter. The Gita should be taken as the most perfect presentation of Vedic knowledge. Unquote. So the point Prabhupada is making here is number one, that we must accept knowledge in the descending process, avaroha pantha, from the disciplic succession coming from Krishna through various spiritual masters. Krishna, of course, is a supreme spiritual master, the Adi Guru. And secondly, he says that when we accept such knowledge, specifically coming through the Bhagavad Gita, then we should accept that knowledge in its entirety, in completeness, in totality. Not that we accept one portion as we like and we don't accept another portion. No. What kind of logic is that called? Does anybody know? Logic of the half hen. What is it called in Sanskrit? Ardha kukutti nyaya. Ardha means half. Kukutti in Sanskrit means hen. Nyaya means logic. The logic of the half hen. There was a farmer who had a hen that laid a golden egg. One golden egg every day. And the farmer had to feed some grains to the hen. So the farmer became greedy and thought, it's very nice that I am getting the egg from the rear part of the hen. But the problem is every day I have to spend money to feed this hen from the front part, the mouth. So let me cut off the front part. So I don't have to feed anymore. I save that expense. So fine, the farmer certainly saved the expense of feeding the hen. But what happened in the process? He lost out on the golden egg every day also. So if he wanted the golden egg, he should have to feed it. Kaviraj Goswami also says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, having faith in Lord Chaitanya but not in Lord Nityananda is again like the half-hen logic. He chastised his brother in this way, when the brother showed less faith in Nityananda Prabhu. It means that we have to accept Krishna's instruction, Krishna's pastimes as they are in totality. Not whimsically according to our own senses choosing this is right, that is not right. Many times, people who are not trained in the proper disciplic succession, they criticize Krishna for his various pastimes. Like, for example, the Rasa Leela. And they say Krishna was this and Krishna was that, he just did Rasa Leela. And then when we tell them that, alright, he did Rasa Leela, but he also lifted Govardhan Hill. Can you lift Govardhan Hill? Who can lift Govardhan Hill? If you can lift Govardhan Hill, then you can also do Rasa Leela. And somebody who lifts Govardhan Hill naturally is not an ordinary person. So then they reply, no, 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 all this is mythology. He didn't lift any Govardhan Hill. Nothing like that happened. Well, then our answer is that if you say that he didn't lift Govardhan Hill, you don't believe he lifted Govardhan Hill, then you should not believe that he did Rasa Leela either. And why should you criticize Krishna for doing Rasa Leela? You want to accept that he did the Rasa Leela and you want a point to criticize Krishna, but you will not believe that he did the Govardhan Leela, then why do you want to accept the Rasa Leela also in the first place? They want something to just criticize. That's the basic spirit of envy that is there in the conditioned soul. Because of lack of knowledge, they want to criticize everything, even up to Krishna. So we have to accept everything in totality. Bhagavad Gita also has to be accepted in that spirit, Srila Prabhupada is saying. The knowledge coming through the parampara is very important. It is our only lifeline, so to speak. Just as when a person is drowning in an ocean and a boat comes along and somebody from the boat throws down a rope and we can get hold of that rope and we can be pulled out. Or if we are drowning in a well and somebody from the top throws down a rope and we hold the rope and we are pulled out. In the same way, we are stuck in this ocean of material existence or in the deep dark well of material existence. And the parampara coming down from Krishna is like that rope. The knowledge is coming down by which we can actually get out of this material world and go back to the spiritual world. So this must be taken very seriously. It is only in the sampradaya, in the proper bona fide paramparas, that true Vedic knowledge is protected, preserved and revealed. So when Krishna says that the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is very confidential, Raj Vidya Raj Guhyam, why does he say it is confidential? The Bhagavad Gita book is available in every library in the world. It is available freely in every bookshop. So why is it confidential? It's confidential because even though the book is widely available, the method of understanding the book is available only in the parampara. That knowledge of how to access is available only in the parampara. It's just like there is a treasure house. And the treasure house, or there is a box, but it is locked. You have access to the box, but you don't have access to the contents of the box, because you don't have the key. So the key is there in the sampradaya, the parampara. With that, you can open the box and actually enjoy the treasure. Utilize the treasure. So when the Bhagavad Gita copies are available everywhere, it's like the treasure box being available. But when you go to the parampara properly, then you get the key along with it. Of course, Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is being distributed is a special edition where the treasure box comes along with the key. The key is also there along with that. In other cases, it's only the box that is given. But you don't know how to understand it. And mostly, they have done such changes in the box that even if you had the key, it's hard to explain, to open it. But with this Bhagavad Gita as it is, you can very easily understand because of Prabhupada's translations, his purports and his introduction. So let's read further. Vedic knowledge is received from the transcendental sources, and the first words were spoken by the Lord Himself. The words spoken by the Lord are called apaurusheya, meaning that they are different from words spoken by a person of the mundane world who is infected with four defects. Unquote. So why are the words spoken by Krishna or the words of the Bhagavad Gita different from words spoken by others?
Because it is Lord's verse which is not from the mundane world.
Because the Lord is not in a position like the conditioned souls. The conditioned souls, Prabhupada says, are infected with four defects, whereas the Lord is not infected with any defects. The Lord is perfect and complete, and therefore his words are called apaurusheya. That means the words are not coming from any ordinary person, any ordinary purusha or a person. The word purusha can sometimes mean person also. So he is not an ordinary person, he is not a material person, a mundane person of this world. So therefore Krishna's words have value. So Prabhupada used to say, it's not that my words have value independently or your words have value. It is Krishna's words Our words become valuable only when we repeat Krishna's words. Otherwise, our words have no value. Because we are infected, as Prabhupada says, with the four defects. So what are these four defects? Let us see. Quote, a mundaner, number one, is sure to commit mistakes. Number two, is invariably illusioned. Number three, has the tendency to cheat others. And number four, is limited by imperfect senses. With these four imperfections, one cannot deliver perfect information of all-pervading knowledge. Unquote. So please give examples of each of these four defects. First is the tendency to commit mistakes. Nobody is free of mistakes. Any examples? Mahatma Gandhi. What did Mahatma Gandhi do? Anyway, he made many mistakes. So, so we know from our experience in the everyday world, we make so many mistakes ourselves every day. In everything we do, we make mistakes. So it's a natural tendency of anyone who is born in this world to make mistakes. There is a saying, to err is human. That means it's a human trait that we make mistakes. So when you make mistakes, then how can there be perfection? Many times you see reports that our college and school textbooks, they have mistakes in the books. So even the knowledge that is being taught in the school sometimes has mistakes. And every now and then when the government changes, then each government comes up with a new variation of the history. If they're a leftist-oriented intellectual, they give a slant to, they want to understand history in one way. Somebody else wants to understand it another way. So mistakes are common. So therefore, there cannot be perfect knowledge when there is a tendency to commit mistakes. Second, one is invariably illusioned. How is one illusioned? Can you give an example? Yes. We consider ourselves this body. That's the fundamental illusion. So when we are in that illusion, how can there be any reality? When you're in a dream, whatever you may think of in the dream is still a dream. The third, tendency to cheat others. Yes.
Science.
Science. Yes, there are so many instances. Just a couple of months ago, there was a big scandal. Some South Korean scientist, who was quite well known, he claimed some very big major discovery in something to do with genes and genetics and something like that. And it was a very major step. And later it was found out that he had cheated. He had fabricated the data from the laboratory. Everything he had done was a big conspiracy from his team. And then he was thrown out of the university and all ultimately when it was found. And there are so many like this. So many with every journal recently also. With one person who published a paper in a scientific journal, later it was proved that he had also fabricated his data. Dhruta Karma Prabhu has written this book on archaeology. And he has said how modern science has fabricated all the data and presented just that evidence which suits their theory. And other evidence which doesn't suit their theory, they have conveniently omitted to mention. So this cheating tendency is there. And those people whom we consider very highly, like the scientists, whom we think are the protectors and the revealers of truth, themselves are subject to the cheating tendency for the sake of name, fame, or even for the sake of preserving their agendas which they have ideologically. So when there is cheating, then there cannot be truth. Truth cannot be revealed. The fourth one is that we are limited by imperfect senses. Any example? Yes. Limited vision, limited hearing capacity. Even dogs can hear more than us. There are certain whistles that can be blown which only dogs can hear. But we cannot hear. Similarly, our vision, our smelling, everything is limited. So we may say, yes, we have telescopes, but how much can we see, even if we have the best telescope? So in this way, with these four defects, perfect knowledge cannot be obtained. Of course, the subject of the four defects is a topic in itself, but we are very briefly discussing today only. But Krishna is not tainted with these four defects. And therefore, it is only He or His representatives who are repeating His knowledge, His words, who are free from these defects. So let us go on to the next paragraph, page 16. Vedic knowledge is not imparted by such defective living entities. It was imparted into the heart of Brahma, the first created living being. And Brahma, in his turn, disseminated this knowledge to his sons and disciples, as he originally received it from the Lord. The Lord is Purna, all perfect, and there is no possibility of his becoming subjected to the laws of material nature. One should therefore be intelligent enough to know that the Lord is the only proprietor of everything in the universe and that he is the original creator, the creator of Brahma. In the 11th chapter, the Lord is addressed as Prapitamaha, because Brahma is addressed as Pitamaha, the grandfather, and he is the creator of the grandfather. So no one should claim to be the proprietor of anything. One should accept only things which are set aside for him by the Lord as his quota for his maintenance. Unquote. So now, in this paragraph, Srila Prabhupada is switching topics. He is going from the topic of Vedic knowledge and how Vedic knowledge is imparted through a series of people who are pure at heart, originally disseminated by the Lord Himself, who is completely perfect and no possibility of any defect in Him. And therefore, that the Lord, who is the source of original knowledge, is also the source of everything else. And then Prabhupada goes on to the new topic, which is that everything belongs to the Lord. Krishna is the creator of everything, including Brahma. Brahma is called the Pitamaha, the grandfather, but Krishna is addressed as Prapitamaha, the father of even the grandfather. And because Krishna is the creator of everything, he is the proprietor of everything, and therefore the last sentence of this is, paragraph is, that one should accept only things which are set aside for him by the Lord as his quota for his maintenance. Which verse comes to mind? Ishavasyam idam sarvam yat kincham jagatyam jagat tena tyaktena bhunjita Mahagadah Kasyas Vidhanam. The famous invocation or the first verse from the Ishopanishad, where it is explained that everything animate and inanimate belongs to the Lord. Idam Sarvam, everything that is here. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. Isha Vasyam, Isha is the Lord. Yat kachit jagatyam jagat. So everything in this world, whether it's animate or inanimate, is a property of the Lord. We should only accept from this world for our use what has been set aside as our quota. This is a big problem. Quota. Everybody wants quotas, isn't it? Nowadays, some days ago, there was a huge problem in our neighborhood, where there were agitation about quotas. Everybody is demanding a right. This is our quota, this is our quota. We want this, we want this. The problem with the conditioned soul is he is more eager to know his rights than his duties. He wants to demand more and more and more. Everyone is trying to extract the maximum that he can in the few years that he has at his disposal. Little realizing that even if he gets a bigger quota at his disposal, still he will have to leave it at the time of death, if not earlier. So what is our quota? Actually, for one who is intelligent, our quota is very little. We don't need much. Whatever is required to keep body and soul together, to keep oneself healthy, is sufficient. But because of attachment to this world, attachment to the pleasures of this world and the prestige and power of this world, we want so much more. Ultimately, we should accept only as much as is necessary for our service to Krishna. That's the bottom line. Prabhupada said, generally, the sadhus and sannyasis like me would walk and they would preach. They would not even sit in cars. But he said, my spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, was one of the first to have a big car in Calcutta. And in those days, to have a personal car was something. There were only a handful of cars in Calcutta in those days, in the early 20th century. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to travel in that car for the sake of preaching when he used to go. So Prabhupada said, just like that, now I am traveling by aeroplanes all over the world, everywhere. So I am using whatever is available in this world in Krishna's service. And it's a fact. If Prabhupada had been like the traditional sannyasi walking around the world, how much would he have been able to preach? He was already an old man. He went to the West at the age of 69. He was almost 70. And then had he just walked, first of all, he would have never reached America. And how would he have established his worldwide mission? So Prabhupada accepted aeroplanes. He accepted so many things. But why did he accept them? Because of his service to Krishna. But he was not personally attached. He said, I am perfectly happy sitting under a tree in Vrindavan and doing my sadhana, my bhajan. I am happy. But for Krishna's service, I have accepted these opulences. So for a devotee, sometimes accepting an opulence is also an austerity. And for some people, accepting a difficulty is an austerity. It can be both. This is called Yukta Vairagya. The principle of accepting from this material world what is necessary for Krishna's service and not using it for sense gratification. Anasaktasya vishayan yatharam upayunjutaha nirbandhah Krishna sambandhe yuktam vairagyam uchyate. That is the meaning of Yukta Vairagya, where we use the things of this world without attachment, not for the sense gratification that these objects may provide us. Anasaktasya vishayan. Vishaya means the sense objects. And one should be detached from the sense objects. Yatha arham upayunjataha. Use them only for Krishna's service. Krishna sambandhe. So it is not that we reject the things of this world because they are material. Even if they are material, but we accept them and use them in Krishna's service if it is possible to do so. Otherwise, we have nothing to do with these items. So, Prabhupada will elaborate more on that in the next few paragraphs. So, we conclude here with this point that we accept that Krishna is the creator of everything, and since everything belongs to Him and not to us, we accept from this creation only what is set aside as our quota. And what is our quota? our quota is that much only which is necessary for our service to Krishna. No more, no less. Hare Krishna. So we'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Question is that yes, Mahatma Gandhi may have had defects, but he chanted the name of Lord Ram at the time of death. Well, maybe, maybe not. We don't know. Somebody says that he chanted the name of Lord Ram, so we don't really know whether he actually did. It's just something that has been propagated down the years that he chanted Lord Ram's name. Maybe he did, good if he did. But at the same time, it's not enough just to chant Krishna's name or Ram's name. One is tested by what one is remembering at the time of death. One is tested by the way one has spent one's life. To the extent that one has devoted one's life to Lord Ram and to Lord Krishna, that is more important than merely chanting Ram's name at the time of death, even if it was chanted by Mahatma Gandhi. First of all, we don't know. And secondly, even if he did, the question is that only one whose mind is absorbed in Ram or in Krishna can actually go back to Godhead. One whose mind is absorbed in political affairs cannot so think of Ram or Krishna at the time of death. Whatever our consciousness has been absorbed in when we are living will be the state of consciousness at the time of death. And that state of consciousness at the time of death will determine where we will go after death. Ajamil also took the name of the Lord, but still he was delivered. Ajamil was not delivered immediately. He was only saved from going to hell. That's all. All his sins were taken care of by that one chanting of the name of Narayan, because he chanted offenselessly. But after that, when he got a new lease of life, when the Vishnu Dutas liberated him from the Yama Dutas, then he lived for another 12 years. He went to Haridwar. He performed austerities and did devotional service. And then he went back to Godhead. So by that chanting, the Nama Bhas, by that offenseless chanting of the holy name, he got liberated from hell, but he didn't go back to Godhead because of that. He went back to Godhead because of the subsequent devotional service he did under the guidance of the Vishnu Dutas. Any other questions? What is the position of Lord Balaram in the spiritual world? Well, he is Krishna's older brother. He is Krishna's dear friend, associate. He is Krishna's devotee. He is everything rolled into one. Okay? Any other questions? Yes.
You say that we should not accept more others for ourselves in it. And if we say for a Rasta, he will accept, he will keep more with himself for future purposes if there is any trouble comes in the future. Is it that it is overburdened, is it
The question is, since it was mentioned that one should accept only what is one's quota, what about a householder? Should a grihastha keep some savings for the future? Naturally, what is one's quota for a householder is different from that for others. The Shastras also say that yes, some degree of saving is necessary. And Mahaprabhu also says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he instructs Shivananda Sen. We discussed it during the Purushottam month. He told Shivananda Sen to look after Vasudev Datta and said, look after his household affairs because he is a very liberal Brahmana and he gives away whatever money he has. So how can he maintain his family in the future like this? How can he live? So please teach him to manage his finances. And he says, teach him to save something because he's a householder. So the Lord himself has advised some degree of saving. But of course the question is how much? These are all subjective questions. Someone who is leading a simpler life is satisfied with a lesser amount. Someone with a different lifestyle is not satisfied with even five times that amount. Plus, circumstances differ, situations differ. So that is something that has to be seen on a case-to-case basis. But everyone, in whatever situation in life, should try to simplify one's existence as much as possible. Live as simply as possible, at the same time being practical of the realities of this world. It does cost money to live in this world. So one should not be artificially renounced to the extent that one has so much anxiety about one's maintenance that one cannot chant Hare Krishna anymore. So one has to be intelligent how to draw a line between our material and spiritual needs in this world. Thank you very much. We'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Gaur Premanande.